And now, WJCU University Heights presents Jewish Community Radio, weekly half hour in this time slot every Friday. As we kick off this week, we have our guests coming in studio in a bit here, and we're going to kick it off with a little bit of new music here from Gad Eldad. I'm sorry, Elbaz, excuse me. And we'll be back with our guests here in a moment. Just a little bit of taste of the new music. And we'll be back here with our guests in a moment here on Jewish Community Radio at WJCU University Heights. And that was a little bit of flavor from the new CD by Gad Eldad. Came out recently live from Caesarea. And just a little taste for an intro here on Jewish Community Radio. And we're going to go right to our guests, as I like to do on the show. First, I want to say that this week we're joined by somebody whose voice you heard last week in the interview. We did a replay last week from our interview with Council Gardens, and our Sunday co-host is here, Steve Turner. Steve, welcome to Jewish Community Radio. I'm glad you're actually made it here live for a change.
Thank you. Yes, it's glad to be here on a Friday. It's rare, but I'm honored to be here today.
Yeah, the Sunday show is a little different. Sunday show is more fun, more lively. We do a lot of fun stuff, fun interviews, and I had a good example of that last week. But this, I want, you know, usually on Friday we kind of do a little different kind of thing. We do kind of a more serious interview. So I hope you don't mind if we bring down the levity just a drop as we go to your guest here that you brought in here.
No, absolutely. Let me tell everybody about our guest. It's an honor and pleasure for me to be here with Fred on Friday to present to our wonderful listening audience my cousin, my very own cousin, Daniel Levine, who's just coming off a great book signing last night at Barnes & Noble, right in the Eaton Collection, where we had over 150 to 200 people there for the book signing.
Yeah, I've been to a lot of book signings in the past, and in general, at book signings and author interviews, you generally have about 20 people on a good day. You have a few people buying the book, and most people come there just to see what's going on and listen. But I would say very few people actually buy the books at the book signings. And what I saw last night was I was kind of worried that the bookstore would actually run out of books, and I was kind of surprised that there was actually enough copies there because. I saw people, you know, one guy buying four, and then at the end, the lady from the bookstore had a stack of, about 3 feet on a cart for signing.
I had to go looking for mine. I said, hey, I need a book, and they said, okay, it's behind the counter.
Yeah.
So I did get one. The book is The Last Ember. That's the title of the book, and it's considered a thriller, right? Mm-hmm. Thriller. And we're going to find out
more of a historic thriller, and it deals with history. It's history, and also it basically fictionalizes some of it as far as what happened in order to bring out a story. But before we go into the story, let me ask Daniel a little bit about you first. You have a Cleveland connection, right?
I do, and first, thanks for having me. It really does feel like a homecoming, although I didn't grow up here in Cleveland. My parents certainly did, and my grandparents did, and for all of the holidays, we're here with great appreciation for all of the warmth that we're welcomed with, especially by folks like Tzvi, and thank you for having me on the show.
It turns out, actually, my father knows your father. We lived there. They were neighbors. so it's kind of
small
funny.
World. Small world.
So, but getting back to you, Bill, but you here. Excuse me. Sorry about that. My apologies there. Getting back to you there. Tell us, before we go into the book itself, I want to know about you and how you came to writing this book and developing this book, because I do realize that this is not something that you just sit down and write. You have to have a lot of background as far as the historical knowledge in order to be able to develop the story.
Right. Well, I think let's take a step back. I mean, the Last Ember is an international thriller set in Rome, Jerusalem, and Gaza, where archaeology is politics and history is more fragile than you think. The novel is set in the modern day, but really it spans 2,000 years in trying to illustrate just how relevant the ancient world is in some parts of the Middle East, in particular the Temple Mount, which of course is ground sacred to three of the world's great religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And this novel, although fiction, all of the aspects which discuss the destruction currently happening beneath Jerusalem are in fact real. In other words, the Temple Mount is a place where the Israeli sovereignty does not control how the Dome of the Rock and the other Islamic structures are administered. And as a result, a lot of the illegal archaeological excavations that are currently really ongoing and destroying Christian and Jewish ruins as we speak are not able to be controlled or even investigated by Israel or other international supervisors. So I think that's a good introduction to how I became passionate about this topic, which is really about preserving the past and trying to prevent the destruction of the Judeo-Christian heritage that exists in Jerusalem.
Now, you've been studying the history of this for a long time. This is not something you decided to write about, just on a whim. You have to have had a lot of background.
Well, that's right. I was fortunate enough when I graduated from law school to clerk on the Supreme Court of Israel. And there, as a law clerk, I saw a case come before the Supreme Court. The Israeli Antiquities Authority was complaining that there were these illegal archaeological excavations that were systematically ripping up all Christian and Jewish ruins, very rich glass and jewelry that had been systematically destroyed to try and deny any kind of connection between those two religions and the Temple Mount. So that these Islamic fanatics were physically destroying these ruins was something that to me was appalling. And when I began to research it, I was fascinated just how much archaeological destruction all over the world is politically motivated. Meaning, it's not because of money. It's not because people are digging up the ruins to try and feed the antiquities trade in museums. It's actually because people are trying to erase a past that doesn't fit neatly within their own politics and beliefs. So that's where the seed for my novel was born. Really, it was a single question. What if someone was so politically motivated to want to control not just the future, but the past?
Because has it happened? Has that happened, actually?
Well, right. So you actually have an Islamic land trust, which is called the Waqf Authority, from the word al-Waqf in Arabic, which means to preserve. And what they are really doing is ripping up all Judeo-Christian ruins to try and deny any Western connection to Jerusalem whatsoever. That is happening. Although the novel is fiction, that, sadly, is not.
So you do use real...
The institutions are real, the laws are real, the dates are real in terms of that the Waqf Authority has been in control of the Temple Mount since the 12th century. All of that throughout the piece is carefully documented so the reader can trust it.
Interesting. And you also, on the front cover here, you have pictures, scenes from Rome, including the menorah from the Second Temple, which was... for lack of a better word, pillaged, and as far as we know, moved to Rome, and has been not seen since.
Well, that's right. I think that there's a lot of mystery in the book, and again, I want to emphasize that the last ember, which, as my good hosts have reminded our listeners, was just released and is on the front tables of every Borders, every Barnes, and every Target in the country. You can jump online on Amazon.com or on the website thelastember.com and pick up a copy, because the thrill ride of The Last Ember is really through the history of Jerusalem. And although the piece is set within 24 hours, it's something which very engaging for people to take in, not just a great story, but the history itself. So that's really the importance for us in terms of being engaged in a discussion of the importance of the history.
Now your research and travels did take you to Rome, correct?
That's right. I was fortunate enough to be a visiting scholar at the American Academy in Rome, where I had these Renaissance manuscripts. And it's when you mentioned the vessels in Rome that were pillaged, there you really start to see how the Roman record as to what happened to these vessels, particularly the menorah of the Second Temple, is one of the great mysteries of the ancient world. It's funny because most times there's more legend than fact when it comes to discussing the vessels of the Second Temple. But here we actually have proof that there is no record of what most likely happened to the menorah of Herod's temple. And for me, this was great ammunition for a novel, because I thought to myself, what if there was an artifact in the ancient world that was as central to the struggle for Jerusalem as it would be in our modern world. And I could only imagine that if there were historical revisionists trying to deny the presence of temples on the Mount, the discovery of the menorah would pose a large difficulty for them. And so what we see in The Last Ember is a narrative that tries to bring people racing from the labyrinths beneath the Colosseum to the arms tunnels of Gaza in a search to protect not just history, but also rather the past itself as it relates to artifacts that are just as important now as they were 2,000 years ago.
And here on Jewish Community Radio this week, we are interviewing Daniel Levin, the author of The Last Ember, a new thriller, historical thriller, which somebody I know last night, I was at the book signing, and compared to the Jewish version of the
Da Vinci Code.
Da Vinci Code. Thank you. Thank you.
I think you're the one person in the world who forgot the name of that.
Yeah. It just suddenly slipped my mind.
Are you impressed that I knew it?
It suddenly slipped my mind.
I am glad this is being recorded. That you know the name of my book and not the name of Dan Brown's book.
That's,
you know, my publisher is very excited that about those comparisons. It's something which I welcome, actually, because if that's any indication of how much people are going to enjoy my book as compared to that one, that's a good indication. But I want to emphasize it's more than a story. In the Da Vinci Code, of course, people were most taken in just by, you know, running one place to the next. Here, what we've tried to do is give people that same thriller pace, but on the other hand, give them a theme that is as rich as the plot is gripping. So while I welcome the analogy, what I also want to emphasize is the actual truth of the narrative that I give over regarding the destruction currently happening of all Christian and Jewish ruins beneath Jerusalem at the hands of an Islamic sect.
Interesting. So we have right now is before I go there, I want to ask you a question. I'm not sure if you can answer, but I'm just kind of curious. Is it possible that the menorah and other relics may have survived this long physically? I saw something on History Channel where they showed the tracking of the Ark of the Covenant, and they ended up showing what may have been a broken tub, more or less. But is it possible that these things survived and could have been removed with the excavations, or is it possible that it survived elsewhere? What's your thoughts? I'm curious.
Well, first of all, the Ark of the Covenant would have been a lot older than the Herodian menorah of the first century. The Ark of the Covenant is its own story, which has been told over and over again and which deserves to be retold, and was probably lost during the first sack, during the Babylonian siege in the 6th century BCE. But here we have something that's a relatively prominent relic, even as late as the 3rd century, where in Rome it was displayed with great protection inside of a Roman temple in the Roman Forum. And we have very careful documentation that in 455 CE, when Rome was sacked, the menorah was whisked away to Carthage. And then from Carthage, it was stolen back to Rome. And what we have are really secular Roman records of the menorah having traveled all the way to Constantinople as late as the 8th century. So, you know, we're really only talking about 1,200 years ago. So the question as to where the menorah is suddenly becomes more of a historical reality than simply a legend.
Okay, we're going to take a break here for a moment and get the new... Oops, I'm sorry. I had the microphone on there. We're going to take a break there for a moment and get some news from Israel with our guest here, Mr. Daniel Levin, from who wrote this great new book titled The Last Ember, and it is available all over the place. But I'm glad to have you on because this is just a great new book. But now let's go for the news from Israel. And welcome back to Jewish Community Radio. That was the news from Israel. And we are here live at WJCU University Heights. I'm your host, Fred. And we have with us today our Sunday co-host, Svi Turner, who's in, as well as our guest who is just joining us here, Dan Levine, who is an author of a brand new book, The Last Ember. And Daniel, let me ask you a question. First of all, I thank you again for joining us here. Your book, The Last Ember, is... this is a thriller, but as you said before the news, that it goes into a lot of the history as well as what's happening currently. I want to ask you a little bit about what's happening currently, because we talked about the past before. You mentioned the Temple Mount. Who has authority of that right now, and what's happening as far as the excavations you mentioned?
Well, the Temple Mount, as I said earlier, is one of the great Bermuda Triangles of international jurisdiction. It's something which has, for the last 800 years, been under the administration of this very secretive Islamic land trust called the Waqf Authority, as I said before the break. And really, they gained their authority over the Temple Mount in as early as 1187 AD, when the Islamic warriors expelled the Christian crusaders from the city walls of Jerusalem. What's very relevant for our modern views of the Temple Mount is that here we have a group that simply does not allow any supervision of how they run the Dome of the Rock, or more importantly, the excavations that are happening beneath it. The shroud of secrecy tightened in 1993 when the Oslo Accords, pursuant to Yasser Arafat's negotiation, took greater control of the Waqf Authority and really expelled some of the international monitors and some of the Jordanian monitors that were supervising the Temple Mount. So here what we have is, although sacred to three of the world's great religions, land which we really don't know what is happening despite its holiness. So although Israel may want to supervise what's happening beneath the Temple Mount, it's strange that they simply cannot gain access. The last person who tried was Ariel Sharon in the fall of 2000. And by just stepping foot on the Temple Mount, there were riots for many years in the territories.
Now, I do recall that there were individuals who have been there, Jewish individuals, but so is it just a matter of, this is my curiosity here, I just don't know. Was it a matter of that was just being because he's a politician or because it was a Jew who went there?
It was basically because he went there without the permission of the administration.
Okay.
Very tight hold.
Okay.
The fact that he was a non-Muslim is something which probably added insult to injury. But I welcome a debate on the topic and would really encourage anyone, of course, we're not doing call-in now, but to the extent you ever wanted to reach out to the station and communicate or drop a line on thelastember.com, the fact that the Waqf has for so long been in control and has had such a flagrant disregard for the sacred heritage of the Temple Mount is something I try and give over in the pages of The Last Ember in a narrative structure. I mean, what would it really mean if someone had found an artifact that would really work against the campaign of historical revisionism that the Waqf currently carries out to try and deny Jewish and Christian remains or ruins that exist beneath the mount. So that's really the seed of the novel, in trying to compare the historical revisionism at work today and the revisionism of the Roman emperors 2,000 years ago.
And so today, you mentioned excavation. What's happened to the dirt that's been excavated? Has anything been found within that dirt?
Well, according to the Israeli Antiquities Authority, they have documented that 20,000 tons of archaeologically rich soil have turned up in the Valley of Kidron, which is right next to the Temple Mount. The strata, meaning the soil that has been dug up, was systematically mixed together to try and prevent any trained eye from making sense of the historical record. So what we basically have is a very intentional effort to try and physically erase the past. There were at one point six bulldozers that were said to be beneath the mount, digging extensively to build huge mosques that could contain 10,000 pilgrims. So really what's happening now is the saddest thing is the amount of questions that remain.
and nobody's able to preserving the past is very important. Nobody's able to somehow act to preserve some of the history. I'm confused.
Well, the jewelry and the glass that we have found in the archaeological soil that's been dumped crudely through using bulldozers into the Kidron Valley, some of them have wound up in the Diaspora Museum or in the Biblical Lands Museum in Jerusalem. They're that valuable, and it just goes towards how much is still under there. And of course, that is a central question, a mystery that lurks in the pages of the novel The Last Ember.
Yeah, and we're speaking with author of The Last Ember, Mr. Daniel Levin, who is just a very big, very interesting thriller you've written here, which has been compared to, of course, the book name I forgot previously. I didn't forget this time. I did not forget Dan Brown's... I forgot the name.
Da Vinci Code.
Thank you. Even when I said that, I didn't forget. That's because I said I forgot.
Another compliment to the publisher.
A second time that someone...
Boy, I tell you...
The Last Ember has now overtaken the Da Vinci Code on the airwaves.
Well, you know, it's funny, too, because when you talk about titling a novel and trying to give over a lot of the theme, you know, one of the reasons that I was attracted to the title The Last Ember is there's a wonderful quote by Virgil, who of course was an ancient scholar, who was speaking of the revisionism by some of the Roman emperors of the day, and he said, "I feel the last ember of an ancient flame." And so for me, I think it's incumbent not just upon the characters in the novel to try and preserve the sacred history of Jerusalem, but the readers long after the last page is turned.
And it's an interesting story because it does give people a feel for what's happening currently, as well as history in a fictionalized, yeah, but also but it brings history to life in many senses, which is something that I really enjoy. When I first heard the book, I was thinking, oh, this is just going to be a novel, but it has a lot of current. What's I'm looking for?
Modern day.
A lot of modern implications, I would say, and right. You deal with it. Before we go here, we have a few minutes left here. Is there anything that really has special meaning to you within the book that really made an impact for you when you were writing it?
Well, I think it was really the connections between the modern world and the ancient world when it comes to revisionism. As I said last night at the book signing, all the time we see statues in museums, many of which are missing their heads or in some cases other important appendages. And those statues were not defaced because of erosion. They were actually mutilated by Roman emperors because those were statues of people whose ideas or even existence was very inconvenient for Roman emperors of the day. And as I was in Israel seeing the physical historical revisionism at work beneath the Temple Mount, the ancient modern parallels grew stronger to me, and I started to think about how interesting it would be if an ancient spy, someone who wanted to avoid the revisionism at work by the Roman censors, was to have a secret with deadly modern consequences that would be just as dangerous and destructive for modern historical revisionists as it would have been for ancient historical revisionists. So for me, what was just really fascinating is to take this journey through the eyes of a protagonist who, none of us have mentioned so far, so I will.
I meant to ask you about that, yes.
A protagonist who is a lawyer, and not just any kind of lawyer, but a lawyer for unscrupulous antiquities dealers. A lawyer for people of questionable morals, and how he has to fight his own battle against historical revisionism, because what does a lawyer do other than revise history in favor of his clients? So it's in that way that the novel The Last Ember is hopefully different than the other thrillers you've read this summer and will make a great August read, because the characters are not not cardboard cutout, and it presents really themes that again will keep you as thoughtful as they will hopefully as glued to your beach chair.
Well, Daniel Levin, I want to thank you for joining us here. Your book, of course, Last Ember, it's a great book, and I want to thank you for joining us here on Jewish Community Radio, and we are here every Friday from 12:30 to 1 p.m.
And Sunday
and Sunday from 7 to 8 a.m. here at WJCU University Heights. And
Thank you very much for having me. To be at a place where both sides grew up is a great honor. And I encourage everybody to submit their comments to The Last Ember, discussed with me directly, and pick up a copy of the book.
Fantastic. Thanks. Daniel, thank you for joining us. And we should be Shabbat Shalom as we go back to the Heights programming here. And we'll be back, of course, next week.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
WJCU, University Heights.